Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 16th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital and the hospital's minimally invasive gynecologic surgery program, led by Drs. Anouk Lambers and Siobhan Hayden. SaratogaHospital.org to learn more. Big news on the COVID-19 vaccine front today. A second experimental vaccine, this one from Moderna, is claiming 94.5% effectiveness. It is good news, but clearly the world not out of the dark yet. And once again, joining us with his expertise is virologist Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He's ready to take your questions about the coronavirus. I do anticipate a lot of calls. Call early, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We'll be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on the line today is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager's research focuses on alterations in the immune system that make the elderly more susceptible to disease. If you have a question for Dr. Yeager, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager, welcome back.
Hi, Ray. How you doing today?
Great to have you here. Big news this morning. It was all over the place. More promising news. A second experimental COVID-19 vaccine. This one is from Moderna and allegedly 94.5% effective. Dr. Fauci calling it some good news. Truly striking is what he said. Have you had a chance to look at the methodology of this study? And maybe you can answer a question or two about this whole thing for me.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to. This is a monumental scientific achievement to get closer to a vaccine within a 10-month period is amazing. So as Dr. Fauci mentioned, I too am very encouraged by this data, and hopefully we'll have a vaccine sooner than later.
Now, this is the second
one.
Yeah,
I'm happy to talk about it. Yeah, second one. And both these vaccines are a new platform, or messenger RNA vaccines. So that's the other kind of monumental achievement, almost like landing on the moon, if you will, because this is a vaccine that has not been tried in humans at this level before. And what differentiates this type of vaccine from other vaccines is that it, again, first is not infectious. It's a blueprint of the virus that our cells take up and start to produce the protein, and our body makes an immune response to this. What's encouraging about this type of vaccine platform, it can be made quite readily and rapidly. It can be scaled up and potentially be less expensive than other types of vaccine platforms. But again, it's the early data, it's still interim data. We have to see what this means going forward. There's still a lot of questions that remain, but I don't want to dampen the good news. We need that right now, that we're closer to a vaccine or vaccines.
Well, we sure do need a little good news. Now, earlier this year, Dr. Fauci said he'd be happy with a COVID-19 vaccine that was 60% effective. This one, according to the study, and I'll ask you about that in a moment, 94.5% effective. I think the Pfizer vaccine was about 90%. Now, as I understand this particular study, it was 30,000 people, and there were 95 infections, but of those 95, only five of those people got dummy shots, which means, and I'm confused by all this, but
I'm happy to clarify.
Okay.
But like I said, you're a good student, so I hope during my appearances here you've learned a lot about immunology and infectious disease.
Oh, yeah. No, I have. And, just don't test me, man. That's all
the
I can
do. Yeah. So the way that these vaccine trials have been set up, so first, one of the questions that I get a lot from friends and family is this vaccine going to be safe? Because, first we'll talk about all this data, but the first hurdle was getting the vaccine. The second bigger hurdle is getting people to take it. So first, the vaccines, the Pfizer and Moderna, they went through rigorous FDA review for their trials. There's different phases looking at safety. Could they generate an immune response in people? And then lastly, are they effective? So the data this morning, Moderna's vaccine being over 95% effective. In their phase three trial, they had 30,000 volunteers. They're given two doses of the vaccine, 28 days apart. And they had a cutoff. So the study design was they were going to look, as soon as they got 151 confirmed cases of disease, they would look to see and peak how many of those got the vaccine, how many of those got a placebo. And the 151 number was chosen based on statistics to figure out the confidence interval. So how confident were they that the data they got was true? Mm-hmm. So when they looked at those, when they reached 95 infections, 95 infections were individuals that got the placebo, and only five of those 95 infections were people that got vaccinated. So that's where they get that 95% effective rate.
Gotcha.
Which was also interesting, too, is when we talk about vaccines, is the vaccine going to prevent infection or prevent disease? So infection was the first measure. The second measure was disease severity, because it would be even more beneficial in some cases to have a vaccine that not only protected people from getting infected to begin with, but lessens disease, right? We talk about the increases in hospitalizations we're seeing.
Right.
We're worried about because hospitalizations are followed by deaths. So we want to prevent that. So encouraging too of the Moderna vaccine is that of those cases that were severe, 11 of those 95, they were all in the placebo group.
Wow. Now, to be clear, when they did these studies of 30,000 people, they're not saying we're going to infect a percentage of you. We're just going to send you back out in the world and track you. Is that how they do this?
Correct. There's been some, when these vaccines were first being developed, there was an idea tossed around is, should we do human challenge studies? So these vaccines, when they are first being produced, they go through animal studies where you purposely infect laboratory animals with the vaccine, with the infectious agent, and then vaccinate first, then infect to make sure it works. Well, of course, there's a lot of ethical issues in exposing someone to a disease, particularly COVID-19, that could be fatal, and we're still learning what the long-term effects were. So the idea of doing human challenges is really out there. So as you mentioned, you basically enlist those 30,000 volunteers, a percentage get the placebo, a percentage get the vaccine, and you just wait. And again, it depends on, unfortunately, how prevalent COVID-19 is in the community and how quickly you get to that 151 cases.
Now, the next step here, Dr. Yeager, is the FDA will have to approve this or not approve this. That means there's more testing for safety, right?
Right. So the FDA had a couple of benchmarks. First, the vaccine had to be above 50% effective, and both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines hit those marks. And then the second level was that the FDA required 2 months of safety data after the second dose of vaccine was given. So both these trials are close to that, so they should be able to have that safety data by the end of this month, I've read, maybe beginning of December. And then they'll give that to the FDA. They'll give their efficacy data, their safety data. And then they also have to give information about how they're manufacturing to make sure that the manufacturing process is also safe. So the FDA has to review that. There's a couple of the boards it has to go through. So potentially there might be some maybe release in December. Both companies, because of Operation Warp Speed, Moderna, because of Operation Warp Speed, have doses ready to go, millions of doses. Now, that sounds like a lot, but remember, these vaccines have to be given in two doses.
Right.
So that 20 million doses comes down to 10 million doses. And then we have to figure out who should get the vaccine first. If this is going for an emergency use authorization, this is what both these companies are looking to get for this approval, is that we don't know yet, is the FDA going to say, okay, you can use it in all populations or a subset? So does that mean healthcare professionals, at-risk individuals, essential workers? So there's a lot of questions that still have to be addressed. In addition to, we don't know, again, these are two press releases.
Right.
As a scientist, we want to see the data. What does the data look like? What is the safety profile? And again, the first few phases, it looks like safety and tolerability were met. That, again, it did cause some typical things you get with a vaccine, some soreness, muscle aches and pains, in some cases maybe a bit more than that. We want to make sure that those safety measures are still holding true for this larger trial. And we don't know yet how it works in different populations. Does it work equally in young individuals and old? And does it work equally in different ethnic and racial groups? Because unfortunately, this disease has impacted certain racial and ethnic groups greater than other ones.
Do we know why that's the case?
It's mixed. There could be some genetic differences, but more likely it's due to longstanding inequities in healthcare and access to healthcare. And also potentially the types of jobs individuals work, they might be more public-facing jobs that put them at a greater risk for exposure.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest, from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Tell you what, Dr. Yeager, you know the drill by now. You're almost a regular on this show. We'll take a quick break. We'll get some underwriting out of the way, and then we'll come back and hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you, 800-348-2551. If you want to call in and ask a question of Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, Dr. Yeager has taught us more about coronavirus and viruses in general since the start of this pandemic in as many appearances as anybody I can imagine on the radio. So it's great to have you here again, Eric. This email now, I don't want to put you on the spot, man, but this email comes from a PhD. So you ready? He's leaving us. Eric, are you there?
I am there. Hi, Ray.
All right. I don't want to get you upset.
I didn't hear anything for a while.
This email came in from a PhD named Tammy. So here you go. You're on the spot. As an educator, you are familiar with grading with rubrics. If you were to grade a holiday gathering like Thanksgiving on its level of safety as opposed to level of mastery, what criteria would you use? What should parents of young children do about the vaccine for kids 10 and under? That's two questions, Tammy, the PhD. Let's go with the first one. How would you grade the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday for safety?
All right. So a rubric is like a grading scheme. And yep. I think it's a great idea to think about with the upcoming holidays in terms of safety. So there's a gradation of what is safe to do, what's relatively safe versus what's high risk. So a lot of things that come into these different thought processes, and myself and my family, we think about these all the time, is what is safe, what's safe to do? So things come into mind such as how many people will be in a room? What do you know about the people in attendance? Have they traveled from communities with high rates of positivity? Have these people been following safety practices that you're aware of? What are their relative risks in terms of their lifestyles? Are they working in a front-facing job? Are they kind of in public service? Is anyone in attendance for these family events a risk group? So are they at a higher age or do they have underlying health conditions? In addition, some things to think about with these gatherings is how long will it be? You know, this disease is something that hits three different things. So density, the number of people, time, how long you're in contact with that person, any amount of airflow. So you want to make sure that these kind of events for family with holidays, and I know it's Thanksgiving and Christmas are special even to myself, but it really is something that it's a risk-benefit analysis, unfortunately, is can we meet with these individuals safely or family members and friends safely?
Yeah.
Does your meeting space allow for distancing? You know, can you do it safely? Maybe you're doing it outdoors, even though the weather isn't that great. Again, airflow, you don't want to be in a really small area with no windows or doors. So really is a kind of a sliding scale of safety and high versus high risk. And also it comes down to your own level of comfort. I think, unfortunately, you know, some people might be seen as, oh, you know, why are you being such a stick in the mud? Why do we have to follow these safety practices?
Yeah.
And I admit, you know, they're not fun. You know, I'd love to be able to see my friends and family as much as I did before the pandemic. But it really is, you know, an overabundance of caution, because what you don't want is you can't go back in time. So if someone gets sick, you know, and you're thinking to yourself, if I just, you know, if I didn't go see them that one day. So it's really something, unfortunately, we have to bear with.
Yeah.
You know, and true, you can also use that as an excuse. Maybe you don't want to see a certain family member. You can say, oh, COVID.
Oh, but, you got it, man. That's exactly what I'm doing. Oh, no, you can't. Next 2022. Nope. Still COVID. Nope. It's fine.
Right. So it is. It's, you know, it's just something that, you know, we're seeing the levels going up in the community. So it's a concern. It's really just what can we do safely? And, you know, think about, yeah, this Thanksgiving, this Christmas might be different, but I'm thinking more about Thanksgiving, Christmas in 2021. 2025, 2030. And I want to see all my family and friends going forward.
So you'll be home with the nuclear family, and that's it for Thanksgiving.
Just my wife and I, you know, I think we're even thinking too, you know, just really limiting it to just to be safe and maybe use FaceTime or Zoom to kind of connect with family or friends. Maybe have a virtual dessert time. You know, and I admit, you know, it's not the same. It's not fun. But, you know, hopefully with these vaccines that are on their horizon, it's just going to be another, you know, year or so.
And then the final question here from Tammy, and then we'll get to the phones, 800-348-2551. Tammy says, what should parents do, parents of young children do, about the vaccine for kids 10 and under?
Yeah, so that's the group we have to figure out and look at the data when it comes out is the vaccine has probably been tested more in adults than children yet. And children are still seeing, the data still supports that children can carry the virus, but they're less able to develop severe disease and require hospitalization. Mm-hmm. The data also supports that most cases of transmission in families are not child to adult. It's from adult to child.
Yeah.
And part of that is biological, and part of it too is that adults are kind of out and about and maybe can bring the virus back. So there's a vaccine, and vaccines are a touchy subject when it comes to children, admittedly. But, you know, we'll wait and see how these vaccines perform. And I think it's more of a discussion from a parent is, should I get the vaccine to protect my child? And then as more data comes through, perhaps consider the vaccine for children.
We're joined today by Dr. Eric Yeager. Let's hit the phones, 800-348-2551. Jim in Gilderland, you've been waiting a while, sir. Go ahead.
Cody, I was just wondering, for this high efficacy that's being reported, is there potentially a component of that that's related to folks doing the right thing with regard to hand washing and social distancing and wearing their masks? And, you know, could that maybe make something that might be 50 or 60 or 70 or 80% look higher? And do you think we'll ever see that teased out in some data down the road, or are they just assuming their population is big enough that all that stuff's going to even out somehow?
That's a great question, Jim. So part of that too is, you know, they recruited 30,000 volunteers for the Moderna study and 44,000 for Pfizer. And to get all those individuals acting in the same way to on a daily basis with following safety precautions and not seeing individuals is not likely. So it does need to be teased out. And then hopefully what they'll do is with the data, they'll say, you know, hopefully the vaccine efficacy is due to the effect of the vaccine and not that the people that got the vaccine acted differently. Now, again, the individuals, these studies are blinded, so the person does not know they've gotten the vaccine or the placebo. For a variety of reasons, you don't want them to act differently, of course, because that also could impact it. You know, a person that got the vaccine could think, oh, I'm invincible, and then become more of a worry and cause different behaviors than they would normally do. So it's something that I imagine they'll tease out. There's probably questionnaires I imagine these volunteers fill out. They might have some data on how their metrics and where they moved around, but it is something to consider because it is, even when this vaccine comes out, I should stress too that the vaccine is not going to be an end-all be-all, that we're still going to require people to follow these safety practices, such as hand hygiene, wearing of masks, and social distancing until the vaccine is more widely available.
How long, and Jim, thank you for the call, how long will it take, what percentage of the population will, in your estimation, need to have taken this vaccine, assuming it is safe and effective? What percentage of our population nationwide will need to take this thing before it's okay to go out there without your mask and whatnot?
Right. So the concept of herd immunity is that a certain percentage of the population must be immune to an infectious agent, either by natural infection or vaccination, to prevent the infectious agent from spreading. So epidemiologists have done a number of studies, and the numbers I've seen out there are anywhere from 60 to 80%. So that would require that the proportion of our population would have to be exposed and immune. Now, there was initially some concern, the idea of, could we achieve herd immunity just by natural infection? And, of course, that is problematic because it's a fatal disease. And there's some evidence to suggest that natural immunity, follow this infection, might lead to an immune response that doesn't last as long as we'd like. And the vaccine might provide us a longer and durable response. That's something that has to be teased out from this data, too. Mm-hmm. So it looks like percent-wise, you know, more than right now, unfortunately, more than the number of people that are saying they take the vaccine. Right now, it's about 50%. We're going to need probably at least, you know, 70%, I think. And that's going to be tough because even the current vaccine we have for flu, the vaccine that people believe in, they believe it's safe, they believe it works. Last year, the rate among use among adults was 48%. So we need to really have this broad social media campaign, educational campaign. So myself as an educator, our healthcare professionals out there, through this program like yours, just to stress any way we can to get that level to where we need to get life back to quote-unquote normal.
Well, you know, the flu vaccine is one thing, and, you know, I'm old enough, I take the flu vaccine. There has been enough bad press on the COVID that I think we'll be well north of 48% once this vaccine hits the streets. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim.
Concerning the zoonosis of COVID-19, I heard a report saying that there are no documented cases of animal-to-human transmission, but there are documented cases of human to animal transmission. Any comment on that?
Did you get that, Eric?
So, I did. Yep. Thanks, Jim. So this this virus, you know, different than some of the other infectious agents we worry about. This is a zoonotic disease. So remember early on when we talked about when we discovered this disease and where did it come from? And still the theory is that it arose in bats, and from bats it jumped to another animal, perhaps a pangolin,
yes,
and then from that animal to people. And there's been unfortunately some cases recently in the news about minks. So the virus seemed to be able to jump from people to minks, and it caused thousands upon thousands of minks died or had to be slaughtered because of the infection. So this virus does have the ability, as long as that same receptor is expressed in other animals, to jump from human to animal. And it's the same for the flu virus. So humans can infect some animals like ferrets, for example. So as long as the animal has the appropriate protein the virus can latch onto, I use that analogy of the lock and key. So this is something that can occur. And I think this is also something to keep in mind for, I get a question a lot, is this virus just going to go away? And I think, unfortunately, it's a virus now that's evolved to infect both humans and animals. And I think they'll likely continue to be in this natural cycle. So this virus, I think, is going to be around for a while. But as long as we have the vaccines, safety practices are followed, and I'm optimistic that we'll have eventually antivirals against it, that it'll become a manageable disease.
Assuming that by the end of the year or early in 2021, there are a sufficient number of these vaccines available, and it might take a while to ramp this up once it's approved, how many months do you think it takes for this, assuming everybody jumps in and 60% of the population takes them right away? Is there a certain amount of time that it will need to take effect in our bodies before people are outside again and without masks and whatnot?
Right. So the data coming out of these trials suggests that after two doses, there was a sufficient immune response. And that's something that still has to be worked out is what is a efficient immune response that's protective. So they measured antibody levels. And we talked a bit last time about antibody titers and viral titers and some of the terminology that's used. But what we wanted to do is use this vaccine to generate an immune response in the absence of a disease. And if we can get a robust immune response, this will usually take about, it looks like if these two trials, the second dose is key, 21 days for the Pfizer vaccine and about, you know, a few days after that. So it looks like, you know, we'll say roughly about 4 to 5 weeks after you've, well, you know, about a week or two after you've gotten your last shot. So in total, about 4 to 5 weeks, that person will have potentially immunity against the against COVID-19. Now, how long that lasts is still something that has to be teased out. You know, there's been some early data that antibody responses, and again, antibodies being important because they can bind to the virus and prevent it from gaining access to our cells. And some people that seem to wane after 3 to 5 months. So that's something we have to keep an eye on. In addition to the timing, I think the other thing I should mention too between these vaccines is the effort it's going to take. I mean, we could have like a warehouse full of these doses, but the effort it's going to take to get them to the right places.
Yeah.
The Pfizer vaccine has some pretty extreme storage conditions, so it needs an ultra cold refrigerator at minus 75 degrees Celsius, and it has a very short half life in a fridge. The Moderna vaccine is more stable, 6 months in a freezer, so that is a little bit easier. The other thing I should mention too is the vaccine race isn't over. There's a number of vaccines being tested still, and many of those vaccines can be stored at room temperature. They might be easier to give. Some of those vaccines being tested might be effective after a single dose.
Wow.
So I think these two vaccines are great. It's kind of our first entry into protection against COVID-19, but I equate it kind of being a marathon. So these two vaccines may have won the first lap, but they may not win the marathon long term. So it'll be interesting to see how many vaccines ultimately are out there in the landscape.
Interesting. So there could, in fact, be a buffet of vaccines, or will there be one? Will there be one winner? This is the one everybody's taking.
Right. Yeah, there could be. And the other thing, too, is unfortunately, these vaccines, even though they're the same, you know, platform, so to speak, messenger RNA, you can't interswitch them. You know, so if you get the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine, your second dose has to be the Pfizer vaccine. So that's going to make it, again, a challenge for when we're trying to get to that level of herd immunity that we're looking for, is making sure that there's enough doses out there, that they're accessible, that people are getting the second dose. How do we track individuals got the second dose? So it's going to be a lot of logistics, and it does seem like the right people in place are being placed to make sure the logistics take effect next year.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. Mary is in Rensselaer. Mary, you're on.
Yes, hi. Your answer to the previous caller kind of was headed in the direction of my question. You were talking about the temperature at which the Pfizer vaccine has to be kept, and that's, I think, 95 below zero. My question concerns, what's the temperature that it's going to be used when it's injected into the body? I know that, I think you mentioned there's a short shelf life, so it has to come up from that sub-zero temperature to a temperature that's, you know, can be accepted by the body safely.
Yeah, that's a So the vaccine doesn't have to be delivered to a person at that temperature. That's for storage and, well, delivery and storage. So it's going to be a bit of a challenge because not all pharmacies and clinics are going to have those freezers. So I know there's been reading a lot of stories about collecting dry ice to make sure those vaccines can be sent to the right places and stored effectively. So the vaccine will be thawed, and then it's made up into the appropriate number of vials. And those can be stored in the fridge or room temperature, but they when they're prepared, they have to be used within 6 hours. So that's the other issue I've read about, too, is that with the Pfizer vaccine, because it has such extreme shipping and storage conditions, that they're going to ship a certain number of doses at a time. So you really have to we'll have to watch and see to make sure that it's easy for a lot of the pharmacies in more rural areas can get access to this vaccine and make up the appropriate doses. So it doesn't have to be delivered at that cold temperature. It's brought up to room temperature, diluted into a number of vials, and then injected into people.
Mary, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences joins us. Have you at all been following some of these potential vaccines that are not under the close thumb of our authorities here? For instance, in Russia, it was famously said that Vladimir Putin took a couple of doses, his daughter did. In China, they were allegedly testing them on populations, whether they wanted to or not. Have you followed the success and or failure of some of these outliers?
Yeah, I've been, you know, looking for, as with the beginning of the pandemic, there's a vast amount of data that's being released on,
yes,
on a daily, sometimes hourly basis. But there is a lot more growing information about the vaccines, and there's well over 100 different vaccines at different stages of being tested. So the one we heard about right after Pfizer's was the Sputnik V or Sputnik V vaccine. And that one, you know, is, I think it was a bit of maybe nationalism, is that, you know, kind of like landing on the moon again, who's going to be first, is that, you know, Russia didn't want to be outdone. That vaccine, I think there's been some concerns because the process, you know, is not as transparent as the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines here in the U.S.
Yeah.
So both companies were very transparent in releasing the information about how their studies were designed and what their endpoints were. It doesn't seem like that same level of transparency exists for the Russian vaccine. Additionally, too, their efficacy was based on just 20 cases. So there's that issue, too, of, you know, how many cases do you want to base efficacy off of and safety and things like that. So I've been following them. It's something to keep an eye on because I know some of these countries have made agreements with other countries around the globe. So it doesn't mean that the Pfizer and Moderna is going to be used globally. There's going to be other vaccines out there. And we do have to think about, you mentioned herd immunity within the United States, but also think about global immunity against this virus.
Yeah.
So we hope that there's equal access to vaccines that's going to provide immunity to other parts of the country and the world, sorry, so that we can kind of dampen down this pandemic.
We have to take a break here, Eric, in a moment, but let me ask you a philosophical question for 1 minute here.
Sure.
You know, we have reports that maybe the Russians, maybe the Chinese, maybe other countries, there has been a fair amount of industrial-type espionage into these vaccines. And there have been some of the studies have apparently been, you know, attempted phishing schemes or spear phishing or whatever to get in and get this information. In your estimation, in your opinion, should all of this, given the global nature of this pandemic and the deadliness of it, should it all be open source?
Yeah, as a scientist, I would encourage just information for all. So the information must be available for all and benefit everyone. It doesn't matter political party, doesn't matter state or country. Of course, you know, that's a bit naive in that there is industry involved and politics involved. But I would hope that with all these vaccines, the information is made available so that as a globe, we can pick the appropriate one. I mean, I think back to how smallpox was eradicated. That was a true global effort. There wasn't it wasn't around during then, but you know, from what I've read, it was, you know, kind of this united effort to eradicate a disease. And why can't we just get to that point again where we can set aside some of the conflicts and just all work together? Because, you know, COVID-19 is a global problem, and the virus does not care what country you're from, what political party you subscribe to. just come together and try to get this virus out of, to be less of a problem than it is today.
Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences joins us. We'll hit the home stretch here on the phones at 800-348-2551 in just a moment. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Joined today by Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences is here to answer your coronavirus questions, and we'll go right back to the phones. Ruth is in Vermont. Ruth, you're on.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Yeager, for speaking about this. I have like three components of this question. If a person has had the COVID-19, does a vaccine help that person, especially if they have the lingering effects of COVID-19? And the part two of that one question, and if the vaccine does help, how does it help and is it safe for those people?
That's a great question. Thanks, Ruth. So the vaccine is tested in these studies for individuals that were not infected with the virus. Someone infected with the virus is still mounting an immune response against it. So ideally, you'd want that person to resolve the infection. And just because you were pre-exposed to the virus doesn't mean you can't get vaccinated. So the vaccine would generate another immune response in that person. Maybe that person would have an even stronger immune response because of that prior exposure. But I would imagine that the requirements would be the person would have to be convalescent or, again, recovered fully from their infection before getting the vaccine.
Okay, Ruth, thanks a lot for the question. And Stephen in Gansevoort. Stephen.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
How you doing?
So I'm a physician as well, and I have to admit I haven't sought out any of the primary data regarding these trials by Moderna or Pfizer. But I think we all are aware that physicians are idiots this day and age, and so are scientists. but political appointees are not idiots. How much interference in what we're hearing about these do you think may be altered or maybe coming from political appointees in an effort to make somebody look good? And is it valid data? Can we trust it? Again, I haven't looked at the primary data, so I probably ought to do that first.
Now it is unfortunate that politics did come into this, and probably politics was good because Operation Warp Speed, you know, must give credit where credit is due, has allowed us to get to the point where we could potentially distribute this vaccine sooner. Unfortunately, it did come into like around the election, wanting a vaccine sooner than later. But the companies did come out and state that, you know, we're going to wait for what the data is. We can't rush this process. Both vaccines did go through a preset FDA process of review for the different phases. I take the companies for their word that they, you know, did collect this data. They're going to provide that data for the medical and scientific community to look at, to critique. Mm-hmm. And part of that will be, you know, the FDA will be made up of individuals, nonpartisan individuals, to look at this data and make sure that it is believable, that it is, you know, accurate to what they propose to collect. And then that'll go into the next steps. And I should mention, too, that you know, just because these vaccines are out, it doesn't mean that the story's over. There's going to be several months, if not years, of data collected after this to make sure the vaccines are still safe, they're still effective. So the FDA and CDC have robust vaccine safety monitoring systems that exist that predate the development of this vaccine. So those will continue to collect reports of adverse side effects to make sure that both of these vaccines, if these are ones that ultimately go out into the field, are both safe and effective.
Stephen, thanks a lot.
So I'm, there's always that little bit of, you know, little voice that says, oh, it's, you know, is it just pushing something out so we can kind of move on? I do really think that these are dedicated scientists. They really want to develop a vaccine that's going to benefit society. So that is my hope, is that the science is there, the data is going to be there, and we'll have a vaccine next year.
Dr. Eric Yeager joins us today on Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the number. Yolanda in Ware, Massachusetts. Yolanda, you're on.
Hi. I wonder if there's any research what COVID-19 does to the reproductive organs, because they talk about damage to the lungs, to the heart, and the brain fog. And as of months, some people got sterile, I think the boys, before the vaccine came out. Do you have any knowledge about any research on reproductive organs?
Yeah, I haven't looked on that particular organ system, but it is clear that this virus can infect more than just the respiratory system. So places like the circulatory system, the heart, and the GI tract, they do express the protein the virus can use to get in. This virus can, in some people, elicit an inflammatory response that can have a dramatic impact on different organ system. So that's the other phase, is looking at data for what is the long-term effects of this illness. And that's the other reason why we need a vaccine, because we're just starting to see that there are people that are those quote-unquote long haulers that experience severe effects, neurological effects, biological effects, and potentially reproductive effects. It's still something that has to be looked at, but that's a great area of research to look for.
Well, Yolanda, thank you very much for the call. It's 800-348-2551. Robin in Schenectady. Robin, you're on.
Yeah, I'm alluding to back a bit to what you discussed about studies with non-consenting people in Asia. We've done that here, and so I'm wondering what percentage of this vaccine testing was done on institutionalized people or people in prison, because it's a common practice.
I don't know if you have any answer for that one, Eric, but go
ahead. So for a clinical trial in the United States, there are review boards that ensure that individuals that are in these trials understand what they're entering in. So unfortunately, there is a past history of individuals put unwittingly into scientific trials, like prisoners. The Tuskegee experiment come to mind. But both of these trials were done on the up and up. Individuals actively decided to join. They had to fill out consent forms. Any individual that was a certain age or couldn't understand the process is not allowed to be in this trial. So, at least with these two studies in our country, there's no evidence that there were people that are unwittingly put into these studies. Now, it does bring up a point about prison populations. The prisons, unfortunately, are an area because of their density and having a population that's ever present. There's a lot of COVID that's going around in our prison system. So that is a population that is potentially one we may have to vaccinate first, because it's really spreading in our community from the corrections workers out into the community. So, from a study standpoint, I don't think anything ethically stands out from these as being suspect. I can't speak to studies that are taking place in other countries, but here these are done appropriately.
Dr. Eric Yeager joins us. The number is 800-348-2551. Scott is in Albany. Scott.
Hi. I've listened that you mentioned it today, and Mario Cuomo's brought it up, and I'm so glad I could get on. The issue with regards to transporting the vaccine at ultra-low temperatures, every dairy farm in America has a nitrogen storage tank to store the semen that's used to artificially inseminate the cows. So there's already a transportation and logistical network in place to transport, material at ultra-low temperatures. And I guess my point would be, perhaps, you could reach out to the industries that are involved in this, and they could perhaps supply, the tanks, the storage units, and the transportation connections to facilitate, the distribution of the vaccine.
Yeah, and I think that'd be great if there's some way that an industry can help out, because I think that's going to be something we want to be able to reach all the individuals we can in a state, in a country. So that'd be a fantastic idea. I wonder, maybe the governor's looking at that, or the country's looking at that.
Scott, thanks a lot. This email was an interesting one from Elise. Elise writes, what percentage of people who tested positive for COVID-19 go on to develop antibodies?
So the majority, I don't have the number offhand, but I can say that the majority of people that are infected do develop antibodies. There does appear to be a link between disease severity and how strong an immune response is generated. So the mild cases, you may still develop antibodies, but they don't seem to last as long as someone that has a more moderate case.
Hmm.
So it does appear like most individuals do develop an immune response, and our immune system is designed to respond to foreign invaders like the COVID-19 virus. Some interesting data came out, and the idea of antibodies is that there are some people that make antibodies against a protein our body makes to fight off the virus. It's a molecule called interferon, and it is designed to interfere with viral replication. So our bodies normally produce that in response to viral infection. And some data, some really interesting data has come out that individuals that have severe disease seem to develop antibodies against that protein. So why our body is making antibody against a protein that is designed to protect us is unclear, but there is at least some measurement for why individuals may have more severe disease than other individuals.
This email from Barbara about the being infected, and Barbara writes, people without symptoms who have COVID, do they eventually clear the virus and lose the ability to infect others? If not, how can we ever stop this? And that's from Barbara.
Yeah, so there's the concern has been with asymptomatic and presymptomatic people. And asymptomatic people are individuals that get sick. They have the same level of virus as symptomatic people do. They can still transmit it as symptomatic people do. Presymptomatic is just someone that doesn't know they're infected until they start to experience symptoms. So symptomatic people, as I mentioned, they have virus in their systems. They can spread it. They will recover, so their immune system will develop, and they will recover. And that clearance is thought to be the same, I believe. It's maybe about 14 days or so. Mm-hmm. So the concern really is not so much how their body works as identifying those asymptomatic people, and that's been a challenge. And you can see why we're looking more towards, widespread testing is we need to identify those people. Because if you're asymptomatic, you don't feel anything, are you going to get tested? Probably not, versus someone that, might feel a little bit fatigued. They might have a fever or some other issues. You're going to get tested to make sure it's not COVID. Mm-hmm. So we need some way, and there's a lot of different technologies coming out, to test individuals to make sure they aren't carrying it so we can identify them to prevent the spread in the community.
Let's go over to Susan in Berkshire County. Susan, you're on with Dr. Eric Yeager.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have heard about these two vaccines. I mean, I've been at work for the last several hours, and I just got on the call at about 2:30. But I have an autoimmune condition, and it concerns me that these two vaccines need to be refrigerated. That makes me think that it's a live vaccine. And as someone with an autoimmune condition, I do not believe it's safe for me to take a live vaccine.
So thank you, Susan, for that call. So it should be clear that, yes, there are some vaccines that contain weakened form of a bacteria or a virus, but these two vaccines, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccines, are not live vaccines. They are pieces of genetic material called messenger RNA, so they cannot cause an active infection. They just cause your body to produce a protein that your body makes an immune response against. The other vaccines that are being tested, there are some that are, some countries have tried weakened or attenuated forms. I agree that there's not data there yet to support their safety. The other vaccine that's been tested, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, is an adenovirus. So it's a weakened form of a virus that's producing the COVID-19 spike protein. Now that one, again, is when it's going through its testing, we're going to have to see, is that vaccine safe and useful for all populations? And that may not be the case. Now for those people that can't get vaccinated or choose not to, the hope is that monoclonal antibody therapies, and we've talked about this in some previous shows, is that in cases where someone can't get vaccinated, there are other therapies and preventive measures that could be used to limit the spread to those individuals.
All right. Thank you very much for that one. Now we go to Jean in Kerhonkson. Jean.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I heard that there are reported cases of people who have participated in trial vaccines that are developing hepatitis C as kind of a result of. Is there any truth to that?
So in the past, when vaccines were not as well controlled, perhaps, and there was maybe sharing of certain needles and things like that. So hepatitis C is a virus that can be spread through body fluids. So the vaccines that are being tested now, again, are going through pretty rigorous procedures for both study design, but also in manufacturing. And the FDA ensures that there are no constituents in vaccines, just like in any other drug, that's going to cause harm, right? Because the vaccine design is benefit outweigh the risks. So in the past, there were vaccines that, way in the past, I'm talking like early 1900s, and so where the safety wasn't there, the ability to identify particular things that could cause harm to a person maybe weren't identified. So in certain vaccines, there was chances of getting something as a contaminant, but these vaccines are really characterized, really purified to where we were, 50 plus years ago.
All right, Gene, thank you very much. Only a couple of minutes here, but let's go to Kevin in Hudson, New York. Kevin, you're on with Dr. Eric Yeager.
Oh, thank you. I have a bit of a a history with this particular case. Back in the late 60s, there was a event known as the Hong Kong flu. And the thing that surprises me is back then I was able to access a lab and I was shown the variety of cells that were connected with that virus. And the thing that I found very surprising is it's almost a splitting image of what I seen back then with not just the Hong Kong flu cells, but the cells that are now identified as COVID-19. Now, the thing is that along with myself, there were 600 of us that had to be inoculated for that condition. And the thing is that I don't know if there was any follow-up done with it, but I do believe that they created a vaccine for the Hong Kong flu. And I'm wondering if you would consider looking into that, because if that research is still there, there may actually be a particular remedy that was developed back then, even though it's 53 years ago. I think it would be a possible.
We only have about 30 seconds here, Kevin, so let's let Dr. Yeager respond.
Sure. Yeah. So what Kevin is mentioning is the Hong Kong flu is a strain of virus that appeared in 1968, and the concern there was that, again, this is think back to 2009, we were all worried about the swine flu. So the Hong Kong flu was very similar in the late 60s, a concern that this was going to be a repeat of the 1918 flu pandemic. So a lot of effort was put into relatively quickly back then to make a vaccine against that particular flu strain. And there were some, unfortunately, what happened is in some of the people that got the vaccine, they developed some side effects, Guillain-Barré syndrome, for example.
Yeah.
So that led to some concerns about vaccines being sped through. In terms of, I think, what Kevin's mentioning about the different types of vaccines produced, there are vaccines based on similar technology. So looking at cell-based and inactivated style vaccines, and those still are the traditional vaccine formats, are being tested for COVID-19.
Uh-huh.
And those trials are ongoing. So as I mentioned with the two vaccines now, Moderna and Pfizer, maybe they've won the lap, but there's still a long way to go. We have vaccines that are still being developed that could prove to be better both logistically and in terms of efficacy.
Well, Dr. Eric Yeager, we are done, sir. Thank you so much. I'm sure we'll be talking to you soon.
Look forward to it. Be well, Ray.
Yep, you too. Support comes from Dr. Jean Shen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniation, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. envisionspinesurgery.com. for details. Thanks again to Dr. Eric Yeager for being here. Thank you for listening. Mike Bowen has been our engineer. Joe Makowicz took the calls. Jackie Orchard's our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, automotive maintenance and repair with our buddy Gordon Fricke. That's tomorrow at 2. Stand by now for the Media Project.